Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
Connection is a healthy and essential aspect of our daily lives. From a warm hug after a hard day to kind words just when we need them, these gentle moments give us an understanding of life's true meaning. But when the ability to connect is interrupted by the hustle of daily life and to-do lists pile up next to the worry of who needs school supplies, sometimes making decisions about our health and the well-being of our loved ones can take a back seat. When it comes to those we care for, vaccines are one of the greatest public health success stories, and along with other measures, are one way to help prevent certain diseases. At Merck, we envision communities where families, healthcare providers, local organizations, and advocates work together. Health equity happens when every person, regardless of age and ethnicity, in every community, has fair access to healthcare, including the vaccines they need. For more information, please visit whyvaccines.com.
Welcome back to another episode of Open Floor, filling in for your host, Michael the Pod Pina. I'm Rohan Nadkarni. I'm joined today by my SI colleague, Jeremy Wu. Unfortunately, we had some technical difficulties recording this episode. We were able to save most of it, though, so we're going to jump right into my mailbag with Jeremy Wu. We'll have to have him on again to do our rookie preview. But for today, please enjoy this mailbag episode with Jeremy Wu, and we'll be back with you guys on Monday. We're going to get to the emails, but I'm going to really put you on the spot right now and ask you an incredibly annoying question that I'm sure you're going to be mad at me at. And after the podcast, you're going to be like, why didn't you tell me you're going to ask me this? But if you really had to, I'm going to give you the same scenario I gave Josh Gondelman a couple weeks ago, okay? You have depleted all your savings and you're in massive gambling debt. You come into a lot of money, but you make another bet, and now you're even deeper into debt, and you have one last chance to win it all back. And you have to bet on which of the top three picks has the best career, Paolo, Chet, or Jabari. You know, your entire family's life depends on this. Which of the three are you picking?
How are we judging best career?
Who's going to make the most All-Star games? Let's say that. Or we know who has the best career. I mean, I don't know. Let's just use the All-Star thing or like, but you know what I mean. Like,
I mean, the All-Star thing is like a different argument.
Right. But, sure. Who's going to like have the most impact and lead their team to the most deep playoff runs? And who in 5 years will we have the highest expectations for?
Yeah. I mean, I still think it's going to be Jabari. Like, I haven't really changed my attitude on this. So this isn't really a hard question for me just because I don't know how much of this at some point becomes my own bias, but you know, I was actually encouraged by watching him play at Summer League. Like, I know he didn't shoot well, and the people who are, you know, naysayers with him are going to, you know, say what they're going to say. But, I mean, he was – honestly, I thought he was arguably the best defensive player at all of Summer League, and he's 18, like – or I guess just turned 19 recently, right? Like, we have to factor in, like, this dude has never been older than his competition ever. You know, now he's at this level, he's going to be able to grow into it. I mean, he's a whole year younger than Chet. He's, like, 8 or 7 months younger than Paolo. You know, certainly the, you know, skill package of that Paolo has in terms of being able to attack off the dribble and pass and all that stuff, like, Jabari doesn't have that and he may not get it. But like, the, you know, I've also said this before, but like, the kind of point I've been making is like, I think it's going to be similar to the, you know, Brandon Ingram, Ben Simmons debate that we had all those years ago. You know, I had Brandon Ingram ranked one that year. That was one of my first years really covering the draft. And, you know, it was easy to look at what Simmons could do. And, you know, he's such a physical player. And, you know, it was very easy to say like what he'd be. But there were also questions as to like why he wouldn't necessarily hit the ceiling, right? And now here we are, and it's 2022, and I think it's pretty clear Brandon Ingram is the more valuable player of the two. You know, but you got to have patience with these things. And, you know, I'm hopeful of the situation in Houston. I'm a little worried because it's the ball might be a little bit sticky there with Jalen Green and Kevin Porter and all these guys who are kind of, you know, guys who are scorers by nature. But, like, you know, I think there will be a pretty big push organizationally to make sure Jabari gets involved. So, but yeah, man, I mean, that guy could shoot, you know, basically he could be the best stretch big in the NBA, frankly. If he can switch everything and knock down open shots. And again, I do think he's going to add to his game. He really cares. He works. Like, you know, my thing with Paolo was always just like, you know, it's very easy to see what he can do and appreciate that, but just like, you know, athletically, you know, he's not like an upper echelon NBA athlete in terms of like explosiveness and getting separation. And, you know, it's a lot of tough buckets, and it's just tough to like make a living that way to a certain point in the NBA, because it doesn't get easier. Right. So I think Jabari has a really high floor just because even if he doesn't add that stuff, he's going to shoot and defend. And you know, he doesn't come with, I mean, maybe this is a flawed concept, but like, you know, I always felt he was a little bit safer than Chet just because I trusted Jabari's shooting a little bit more. You know, Chet shot it great at Summer League. So, you know, if Chet's really going to shoot it like that, it changes things a little bit. But, you know, Jabari is still the guy who I would, you know, I would do it again. I'd put my chips on him.
I like it. Let's move into some emails. I want to start with this one from Elliot Gold, because Michael Pina saw this email in the mailbag and read it out loud to me with such disdain in his voice. And I can't repeat the words he said in answer to this email on this podcast, because this is a family show. Woo, I'm going to ask you this question because you're constantly slandering one of these people in our group chat, I think mostly just to make Mike angry. But Elliot writes in, no subject. This is the entire email. Tatum for KD straight up. Who says no?
Who says no? I mean, I think Boston has to say no.
Yeah, right? I think Boston has to say no there.
Yeah.
As but much I like as where like, your mind is at, Elliot. Pina was very upset with that one. He told me the fake trade that he would offer for the Celtics if he were Brad Stevens, but I'm gonna let him keep that one in his back pocket for when he's ready to share about it. But needless to say, it was delusional, just as his vote for Marcus Smart for Defensive Player of the Year. Let's get to another email. This one comes in from David McCullough. David writes in, hey, Rohan, Shelby, and whoever else shows up. Well, David, today we got Jeremy Wu. He says, one of my favorite things about Open Floor is the clear love and respect the hosts and producers share for each other, aside from Michael and Chris's begrudgingly understandable absences. David, just to let you know, Shelby does not love and respect me. He merely tolerates me. David writes in, with that in mind, what are some of your favorite NBA bromances? I mean, the strong personal bonds between specific NBA people that shape the league in subtle or not so subtle ways. This question was inspired by hearing DeMar DeRozan and Coach Pop lavish praise on each other several months ago when it was clear DeRozan's time in San Antonio helped him grow as a player. There are also some questionable bromances, like what is going on in KD and Kyrie. Even if they aren't closest friends now, their connection continues to reshape the Brooklyn Nets for better or worse. Wu, who comes to mind for you? Who are some of your favorite NBA bromances?
Yeah, you know, when I hear this question, I always veer towards the like semi-obscure, like LeBron and Dwayne Wade, like whatever.
Yeah,
sorry, guys.
Yeah,
we know they shaped the NBA, but no, I mean, like the Tobias Harris Boban one was always really great. I always appreciated the Steven Adams and Enes Kanter one.
That was a good one. That was actually
funny because that was back when Enes Kanter was funny.
Yeah, that I don't know if Enes Kanter was ever funny. He was, to me, he was like a used car salesman version of Embiid. But it was back when Enes Kanter was innocent, I guess.
Yeah, it was,
in the public eye. Yeah.
It was a shtick that I always thought was entertaining. Yeah. But also, I just think Stephen Adams is great.
Yeah.
You know, I like the who's. I think it was like the Tim Duncan, like jersey retirement or whatever ceremony or whatever. And you had like, or maybe, I don't remember all those Spurs guys, like the Tim Duncan, Tony Parker, uh-huh. Manu, like, I don't remember whose jersey retirement it was, but I remember like streaming some of it. And it was like, you could just tell they were getting like all fuzzy mm-hmm. with each other. And I was like, oh, that's a good one. Like those guys, I thought it was always kind of cute.
Yes. The Spurs big three.
Perspective.
Yeah, the Spurs big three friendship. Had a really good one. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, also Boris Diaw and anybody.
Yes,
all the French guys. All the French guys. Yeah, that's I don't know. That's like up top in my head.
Those are some really good ones. I'll throw some more out there. Darius Miles and Quentin Richardson, who host a podcast together now, the Knuckleheads. I love that they're still friends. That was such an exciting time. Especially if you were playing basketball video games, to use the Clippers. And it's a real shame to me that that team didn't work out. And it genuinely warms my heart that Darius Miles and Quentin Richardson are still friends. I believe one of them crashed like Alonzo Mourning's jet ski. That's like a good anecdote that's come out of like their new podcast together. So that's a really good one.
What about Marcus and Markieff Morris?
I don't...
Brooke and Robin Lopez.
Yeah, okay, actual brothers. Very funny, Jeremy. I want to throw Udonis and Dwayne Wade on there, a true partnership. Udonis is the enforcer, willing to take all the flagrant fouls for D-Wade. D-Wade paying a bunch of his fines. They're still friends. Udonis Haslem, the godfather to Dwayne Wade's youngest child, Kav. I love that stuff. I live for, you know, the players getting involved with each other's family. I think Kyle Lowry is the godfather to Jimmy Butler's daughter, so I got to throw that one in there. TJ McConnell once told me that his like closest friend on the team was Jimmy Butler the year Jimmy was in Philly. So I'm going to throw that one on there only because it really surprised me. I was not expecting Jimmy Butler and TJ McConnell, but I feel like in retrospect now it's kind of like up Jimmy's alley to be friends with the most obscure player on his own team. There are a lot of good NBA bromances, though. I really like this question. I'm trying to think of some more 90s ones, but like with social media and stuff, we don't really have the insight on what the true bromances were back in the day, you know?
Yeah, no. I mean, you'd have to do some book research, I think, and to find that out. I don't know. That's a good Chris Herring question.
It is a good Chris Herring question. We'll have to bring him on and ask
John like Starks.
Yeah. I wanted to say, oh, man. I want to know who on the 09 Magic were friends, because I love that team. Like, who was Hito Turkoglu's bro?
I don't know. But I just thought of a good one. Genuinely, the Joakim Noah, Derrick Rose one is great.
Mm.
Those guys are like... great, great friends, I think, to this day. And I say that since you got to talk about the Heat, I have to say that.
There we go. I would love to hang out with Joakim Noah. He seems like one of the most fun NBA stars of all time.
Yeah.
This next email comes in, and this is also from David. So, David, you're getting a doubled up today, but this I'm bringing this question up because I feel like I'm ignorant to this. And Jeremy, maybe you know some more about this. David writes in once again, dear Open Floor leadership team. I also like the evolution of his emails as we continue to cycle in and out hosts. But he says, I've just encountered a joy bomb in the form of the Cleveland Cavaliers 1975 theme song, Gotta Make It Happen. I'm a Cavs fan and obsessive vinyl collector, so I immediately bought the 45 for a mere $30. This is the steal for the happiness it will bring me. He even came across an SI story from 2013 that lists the five cheesiest NBA theme songs. So he asks, any favorite NBA theme songs and any ideas for modern ones? Is this a thing? Do teams have theme songs?
Yeah, I mean, the only one I know of is the Bulls had one. And I remember this because when I was growing up, I went to a couple games like in the post Jordan years, like the really, really dark ages of the Bulls. And it was, they were still using it. Like, I don't know if it was used before that, but it's like only the Bulls. I think it's on YouTube. You can find it. I'll find the link for you. And I remember how it goes, but it's like the only theme song I can think of. It's like only the Bulls. And it's like a whole, it's honestly pretty funny to, well, it was, I guess it was even funnier because I actually distinctly remember this, my first Bulls game as a kid. I think it was like 2001 or 2002. So you're in there and they're playing it on the scoreboard and I'm sitting in there watching and I'm a kid and it's like, oh, here's Marcus Fizer dunking. Like, yeah, sorry. Like, I wish I was born like 6 years earlier. But I got Marcus Fizer and, you know, no, not to slander Ron Mercer and Marcus Fizer and Eddie Robinson. But that was the team that I got when I was eight. So
what? I know the Heat used to play the Heat is, I mean, they still play the Heat is on after wins, but I don't know if you could call it a theme song. I know, I mean, obviously the song you associate even more with the Bulls is Serious by the Alan Parsons Project, you know what I mean? But I wouldn't call it.
I guess that is.
But I don't know that it's their theme song. It's like their intro music.
Like, it's not like a bespoke theme
exactly
for the team.
Exactly. Yeah, a bespoke, yeah. It's not like the Dolphins have, you know, they have their theme song that their owner tried to ruin too with the Jimmy Buffett one.
I really just wanted to say bespoke.
Yeah, no, that was a good use of bespoke.
It's a very fancy term.
You know, even the Lakers, I guess they play, you know, I mean, there's so many songs about Los Angeles that you can play at all times. Are you surprised more teams don't have, like, why hasn't Rick Ross come up with a theme song for the Miami Heat? You know what I mean? Why hasn't Kendrick Lamar come up with a Lakers theme song? Like, what are we doing here? Like, why are there not more, you know, how do we get that trend going, Wu?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a fair question. I think the main theme song, and when you told me this, the main one that came to mind was the legendary Scott Stapp Florida Marlins collaboration, which I'm sure you know well. I'm sure you sing it to yourself in your sleep. Come on, Marlins, make us proud.
How the Marlins got a theme song?
Hey, Scott Stapp was available. Okay, like I'm sure the Heat could get him if they wanted.
Do you think the Bulls should make their theme song more prominent? Do you think only the Bulls should be, like, should it be more front and center, or do you like that it's this obscure thing in the background?
They might have brought it back. I would have to look it up. I feel like they might have brought it back. Oh, yeah, here we go. I guess in 2014, they brought it back with Fall Out Boy and Lupe Fiasco, according to YouTube, which sounds like something I'm not going to watch, but I'll watch this later.
What an uncomfortably 2000s occurrence. Like, let's get Fall Out Boy
Fiasco. The dark side. That's the dark side of, like, oh, here's two local artists who are going to get to do a cool version of this for the kids. And it's like, it's 2014. The kids don't like Fall Out Boy and Lupe anymore. I guess maybe they do. Lupe's new album was good, actually.
There we go. Let's move on to another email that I think was like engineered in a lab to make Draymond Green angry, because the subject is literally era comparison. And I do love answering questions like this, and I think we've done this to a degree on this show before, but this one comes down to one player who I think is really worth discussing here. This is David Kowalski writes in, longtime listener, first time caller. Question about recent discussions about players in the wrong era. David writes in, if Shaq came out in 2022, is he drafted high? I can hear the critics. Can't shoot threes or free throws. Clogs the lane. Can't guard in a pick and roll. How much of a chance would he get in today's game? David goes on to ask about some other players who are maybe ahead or behind their time, who we can get to. But I wanted to ask you, Wu, about Shaq, because I love the draft angle of this. How would the NBA handle a prospect like Shaq, you think? This 7-footer. I mean, you have to remember at the time when Shaq came out of the draft, I mean, he was a lot more athletic than even when he was by the time he got to the Lakers, when he was still obviously incredibly dominant physically. I mean, he was putting the best defensive centers on their backs. How would you, like, how do you even begin to conceptualize someone like Shaq coming out in today's draft landscape?
Yeah, I mean, that was the first point I was going to make. You know, Shaq at, you know, whatever age he was, I guess 20 or 21 or whatever. I don't know what the, actually, I have to look and see how old he was. But yeah, I mean, Shaq at, you know, rookie year Shaq, different animal than, you know, 2003 Shaq and beyond, right? So I still think he'd be probably regarded very heavily just because that guy was so good and so overpowering. And I don't know. I mean, these arguments are always difficult because do we want to assume like this player has access to, you know, modern coaching and modern development and like, you know, knowing what we know now about how the NBA has played, like if Shaq came in the NBA right now, yeah, he'd be shooting threes. So at least they'd try. Right. So like, it's always a tricky argument. But at the end of the day, look, I think Shaq is so good at what he does. I think you have to assume that, like, you know, if all things were equal, I mean, if you look at, you know, the Embiids and the Jokic's who have kind of like, you know, they're more conventional and they're not, you know, I guess it's tough because those guys are such unique players. But I guess that's sort right. of, when we're talking about the best players ever, that's often what it becomes, right? It's just like this guy kind of breaks convention one way or the other. So, like, you know, if we're talking about Shaq, I would think that, you know, if he had access to what players have access to now, yeah, like a slimmer Shaq could easily be one of the dominant bigs in the NBA just because, again, you're not really going to throw ball into the post that much now, but you can still play through Shaq post-ups, right? I mean, he's still going to be able to overpower people, right? Like, think about how many, like, really skinny bigs in the NBA would just have no chance.
It is really interesting to think about if you apply kind of the argument of Shaq with modern coaching, do they try to turn him into like a rim runner, athletic center type who is, you know, just running both ends of the floor super hard? This is going to sound absurd, and I'm already regretting saying this, but do you try to make him like a supercharged version of DeAndre Ayton who is just super athletic running from rim to rim, maybe has a little bit of offensive flair, but you can still throw it into him in the post? Because I don't think even the most athletic version of Shaq could have the shooting touch that Jokic and Embiid have.
Right, right.
Which is really what separates them, because they're both incredible post players. Embiid obviously draws a ton of fouls, something Shaq would do. Jokic was, I think, one of the best post scorers in the league last year. I mean, he was. I just don't know if it was number one or top three, but yeah, like what they're also able to do is score in other ways or pass, playmake, etc. Shaq, I think, was a really good passer, and that's maybe an aspect of his game that would have been owned more. But I'm curious, like, do you see if you get a big man like that? That's, I mean, it's just so crazy now because even like Wembanyama, who's coming out next year, it's like this 7-footer, but the whole thing is he can, you know, pass, shoot, dribble, etc. Are they even trying to make rim-running centers anymore, or are they all being taught to shoot a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, I think, I don't know. I think you try to see if everybody can shoot now. It's kind of like here nor there. I mean, not everybody will. But, you know, I mean, even if you look at this year's draft, I mean, you know, Jalen Duren and Mark Williams, you know, two bigs who are, you know, picked in the top 15, and neither of them are really – three-point shooters still have value in other ways, right? And so, you know, it's always a nice plus, particularly, you know, if you're not a super, you know, effective offensive player, like having that three, adding it, like, you know, the way Brook Lopez kind of added that later in his career. Obviously, he was a really good offensive player for a long time, and the league changed, and he changed with it, right? So it's always tricky. I mean, there is, like, a home for these non-shooting centers, but, like, who would you say is like the best non-shooting center in the NBA? Like Capella? Like maybe, you know, 3 years ago when he was
That's a great question, by the way. Right. Who is like, the best non-shooting center?
Like he kind of, you know, Clint peaked with Harden, you know, 3 or 4 years
Bam
ago.
Bam probably, yeah.
I guess Bam, if we want to call him a center, which you and I have discussed before, like he probably falls in that bucket. Like he does so many other things that it matters. But it's, you know, it's still definitely a tricky thing sometimes to play with that type of spacing and have to sort of scheme around it.
I don't want this will derail this conversation because we'll literally talk about this for hours. I know it, and we've mentioned this a little bit before, But David does go on to ask, who are some other players who would have been more or less successful if they played at different eras? He brings up how Boban would have had more value in the 90s, early 2000s. Mm-hmm. That's a great one. Tony Kukoc would be a god now. I think that's a great... This was an interesting one. He says, Jahlil Okafor, 15 years too late. What do you think of like Jahlil Okafor in 1994?
Oh, yeah, 100%. He would have been great. He would have been great. And I say this as someone who extensively watched Jahlil Okafor's high school career, like way too much of him. He would have been awesome. I mean, you know, the at a young age, his aptitude as a post scorer was like unreal. And, you know, I mean, I had him ranked high in that draft, and obviously he was still picked third, right? So like there was still, I think it was just not everyone then realized where the NBA was headed, right? Like he was right. He really came along at like the exact wrong time, because like if he came around now, at least the expectations would be realistic. And, you know, you can try to figure it out, but like, you know, 2000 and what was that, 15? 15? That was. So, I mean, that was like right as the NBA was really changing. And it was before everybody knew exactly where it was going. So he was, I think, really disadvantaged by, you know, the timing of all that. But, you know, at that, I mean, I still haven't really seen a like, teenager who could, you know, score in the post the way he did. And, you know, obviously they won the title at Duke. So, it, you know, he accomplished things through that. But, yeah, sign of the times. Kind of crazy.
It really is, and it makes me very sad that post players like him just don't really have a place in the NBA now. And even like some of the really good ones, like you think of a guy like Boogie Cousins, he can come in during the regular season and like win you a game because he posts up eight times against the backup center in the third quarter and your team goes on a big run and that kind of flips it. But then even then, by the time the playoffs start, it becomes so much more tricky to use a guy like that. It's really sad to me. I brought up this guy and I wanted to ask you a question or two about him before we run away today. But Wembanyama, Victor Wembanyama, who is kind of like already being talked about as the prize of the 2023 NBA draft. I'm just curious, like, when did he first get on your radar? When did he first kind of start garnering this hype as a prospect? What do we need to know about him? And do you expect like an absolute crazy tank off for him specifically?
Yeah, I mean, this is going to be something that we're going to talk about for the next year. I mean, I would say, you know, he was put on my radar. I mean, I got to give props. You know, that Jonathan Givony, I think, was the first person who wrote something about him. Like, I guess that was probably like 2 years ago or 18 months ago. I don't remember when, you know, but ESPN, they were at the, you know, the sort of the front of that, the guy that did it first. And so, you know, his star has really grown in that time. You know, I've watched him play a lot on tape. It's been a really long time. I was talking to this about with someone in the NBA, a friend recently. It's like, when was the last time there was like really, truly like a unanimous number one pick this early, like in the NBA circles? And this is no offense to Scoot Henderson, but it's pretty clearly Victor. You know, as long as he's healthy and comes into the draft with no significant changes in trajectory, I mean this guy is so unique, and I'm really excited. You know, I'm hoping to go over there and see him play this season. You know, I think he's listed at 7'3". He's so long. I mean, he covers, I don't know, you probably haven't watched him. I'm excited to get your takes from when you actually watch him, but just like, he covers so much area defensively. Both, you know, he can get out onto shooters, he can retreat and like pursue. So it's like the way I kind of explain it, it's like a 360 degree like bubble that he covers in terms of like vertical, horizontal, just like sucks up space. And it's like nothing I've seen in as long as I've been doing this. And so offensively too, you know, he flashes, you know, he can shoot, he's adding stuff off the dribble. You know, at his size, I don't have a clear grasp on like how functional he's going to be as like a throw the ball to him type guy yet. But there's certainly the upside for that to be part of his game. It's just like total, like we said before, like the best players in the NBA always break convention in some way. And I mean, he might break it like all over. You know, someone I'm very excited to watch more of this season. I think look, we're going to see, I think, a lot of teams after 20 games, things aren't going the way you expect it. You're going to see some stealthy tanking, I think, take place. And again, it's hard to tank, and we always, you know, talk about the merits of that. But no, I mean, like, this is the type of year where yeah, you have him, and then you have a number two guy in Scoot Henderson, who at least is also a really good player, a good prospect in his own right. I think this year's lottery, I think everyone is hoping at this stage that it's going to be a little bit deeper. And I have my first draft board for next year coming out in the next few days. So, you know, we'll see
there
that.
There we go.
You know, we'll learn more. It's still really, really early, but we know for sure, I think, that as long as nothing crazy happens, I mean, Wembanyama is going to be the guy that everybody wants, and we're going to hear a lot about him. So
when you see a guy like Wembanyama, so I feel like at some point we have to see the effect of the way the NBA is going into lower levels of basketball, right? Because people aren't raising post scorers anymore. As we mentioned, if you had a prospect like Shaq, you wouldn't only throw in the ball 50 times in the post anymore, because, you know, people who want to make the NBA are ultimately realizing that's not the skill they're going to need to succeed at the highest level. So when you see a guy like Wembanyama, you mentioned 7'3", can cover all this ground, maybe he's not a polished scorer yet, but I think it's fair to say he plays, this is me talking about the YouTube highlights I've seen, offensively he still plays a little bit more like a wing than a quote-unquote NBA center, or at least what our old definition of an NBA center used to be. So when you see someone like Wembanyama, do you feel like he is unique, one of a kind, or do you feel like he's maybe first in a wave of, are we going to start to see a lot more prospects like that, 7-footers who are being asked to play like a wing? Like, when do you think we might start to see that kind of landscape shift, or is it still going to take a really long time?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say yes and no. Like, I don't think we can assume we're going to see another one of him for a long time, if ever, just with his proportions and whatever. Like, look, I mean, I think he's going to have, like, you know, best case scenario, he can be like a Tim Duncan, Kevin Garnett type of like centerpiece. You know, that era, you know, those guys were in at their primes, you know, really mobile and could do so much stuff and contributed on both ends. And like, you know, that's, I think, what you're hoping he's going to be. But I do think that, you know, to your question about the trend, there definitely is the trend towards, you know, we are seeing these bigger, you know, players with more ball skills. It's the size skill combo, because I think, you know, by and large, the development system has at least started to catch on to this, where, again, a lot of the best players we're seeing in the NBA right now are not born in the US and, you know, developed elsewhere. And, you know, Giannis and Jokic and, you know, Luka, and these guys are all really big guys who are really skilled. But I think we've kind of, you know, caught on to that need for, you know, skill development and bigs, right? So, you know, you could look at this year's draft. I mean, Banchero and Holmgren and Smith are all, you know, really, you know, they're all 6'10 and up, and, you know, do have, you know, varying, you know, various skills that are, wouldn't necessarily associate with players that size. Right. So it is a wave where I think it's a good thing for the game that we are seeing these guys come around. I think that will continue. But will we see, you know, a 7-footer like Victor, with, you know, the type of length and mobility and instincts that he has? Probably not. You know, that's part of what's so exciting about him. Right. So, I think that's where the game is going, and, you know, we'll see this happen, and it's going to be really interesting. Cause, you know, I always said, like, I thought it'd be interesting, you know, years ago I was saying, you know, it'd be cool to just have a lineup of like 5, 6, 8 guys and just be able
to play away, yeah. Right? Basically what the Clippers are trying to do.
Right. And so now teams are actually trying that now.
Yeah.
It's cool. But you still have to have guys. It's less about size and it's more about skill sets. Right. So it's like, how do these skill sets fit together? And yeah, we're just seeing these different skill sets emerging in the, you know, different types of athletes.
Wu, I want to get you out of here. This is a question that Chris, Mike, and I talked about, I think, on our post-finals pod. We still have to figure out what we're going to do with the top 100 this season.
Oh, yeah. We do have to do that.
It's coming around the corner. But I wanted to ask you, because this is so embarrassing that Mike and I, like, actually, we had not seen each other in years. He just had a child, and immediately we started talking about these basketball things, but we started talking about the top 100 a little bit. I'm realizing now that this might be the most difficult year since Sports Illustrated has started this project to figure out who's going to be number one. Do you have a clear idea in your head who's going to be number one? You don't have to say it right now, but if I asked you to make the list right now, do you know for sure who would be number one on your list?
No, I don't think I've landed at one. Like, I actually drafted a list like last month because I was bored, just to like have something to look at. Mm-hmm. But yeah, number one, that's something I would need to like discuss with you guys. Like, I don't really have a firm opinion on it because last year it felt like, oh, KD for sure, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that was the right answer. But
Chris Herring likes to remind us often that it was not.
I still think it was, but
I do think I do as well.
But yeah, frankly, I mean, you know, it's tough. I mean, you can argue for these guys. I mean, Giannis is so consistent. I don't think it can be KD now because we don't know where or if he's going to play or how much. So, like, I think that's going to kind of, in my mind, preclude him from being one. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's Giannis, and I guess you could argue for Luka, and you could argue for Jokic. Obviously, I don't know if we can put a center at number one, but yeah, you could argue for him. And there's Embiid, who I don't think I would say is one. And then who am I forgetting? I'm forgetting some other people too. I mean,
it's just weird because LeBron and Kawhi are out there, but I don't think either of them you could put at one.
No, I don't think either one. Like, Kawhi coming off injury, yeah, can't.
I think if we put Jokic at one, I honestly think there'd be riots. There'd be something going on in the street. Is there an argument for Steph Curry at number one?
Oh, that's who I forgot.
Yes, damn. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, they just won the title, but we have to project forward, right? So it's tricky. That's a discussion that I don't know when we're going to have, and I might be on vacation in another country while we're having it, so I don't know how much I will be plugged into this. But like I said, we're all kind of, yeah, this is going to be a tough year. We got to figure out how we're going to do this. We should talk about this.
I'm excited for Mike and Chris to return from their respective vacations so that we can discuss it. I hope Mike gets some of the takes that he had when I saw him in person off his chest. I know I keep bringing it up, but I was appalled at some of the things this guy was saying. We do need to start getting his son some Miami Heat gear, though. But that will do it for today's episode of Open Floor. Thank you so much for joining us. When's your big board coming out? I want to make sure we direct people to it.
I think it will be, as of now, it is scheduled for next week.
Okay.
I don't know which day of the week we landed on, but it will be next week.
All right. Please keep an eye out for Jeremy Wu's 2023 NBA draft. Big board, please keep your emails coming, openfloormail@gmail.com. Thank you again to all our listeners, all our emailers, sticking with us this summer through just a variety of hosts and guest hosts. It's been fun for me. I hope it's still been interesting for you guys. That'll do it, though. Until the next episode, please continue to enjoy the NBA offseason.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.